Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of today's Football Times, a podcast that looks at stories from the football world. I'm Rob Fletcher and I'll be in the dugout for today's episode with a distinct cup focus, because who doesn't love a good old-fashioned knockout competition? I'm joined today by Dave Bowler. Hi Dave, how are we doing?
Evening Rob, looking forward to having a chat with you and with Aidan as well. There's plenty of good stories around at the minute.
Yeah, definitely. And hi Aidan, welcome to the podcast.
Good evening, Rob. Yes, as Dave says, very much looking forward to this.
Excellent. Right, let's get straight in there. We've got, like I said, quite a cup focus on this one. We had a huge final. We're recording this on a Sunday, so last night at the Copa Libertadores. So, Aidan, tell us all about it.
Yes, I find the Copa Libertadores quite fascinating. I guess it's just the colours, the kits are so much better than we have in Europe, and certainly way better than we have in England. The fans, the noise, it's all so exotic and appealing. And ever since the last few editions, I think the BBC have covered it in one way or another. This time it was in their app or an iPlayer and so on. But, you know, it's easy to track down if you're available to watch, and it's well worth doing so whenever people get the chance. This was a fascinating clash as well between, I guess, South American royalty in Boca, a team who had won the Copa Libertadores six times and were seeking to go level with their Argentinian rivals Independiente on seven, at the top of the winners chart, if there is such a thing. And they were up against Fluminense of Rio, who have never won it. And I guess arguably the biggest side, arguably, who've never won it. Well, at least until now. Spoiler alert. this was Boca's first final since the famous one in 2018 when it had all kicked off in a variety of ways against River Plate. And the final ended up getting played a few weeks later at the other side of the Atlantic in Madrid. But that was another one that we could all focus on over here and get plenty of coverage of and plenty of action. And that was spectacular. And this is Boca's first final. Since then, the finals played in Rio. Now, this can happen in these finals. Ever since that 2018 one, it's been a one-off final. So that incident of a two-legged final between Boca and River or anyone else, for that matter, can never happen again. It's a one-off final, and the Maracanã in Rio was where this one was going to be played. That is Fluminense's home ground. I mean, it's the home ground of several others in Rio as well, or from time to time anyway, but certainly Fluminense play their home games there. It's the way it goes, I guess. That's happened in Champions Leagues as well. Bayern, I recall, probably a decade or so ago against Chelsea. It does happen. But I guess it never quite sits right when it's supposed to be a neutral final, does it? But I guess these things have to be decided in advance, and Maracanã is a fairly obvious pick. But what we did get to enjoy because of that is various clips on social media and the likes of the Boca fans taking over Copacabana Beach, very, very much reminiscent of their countries, their national team's fans in the 2014 World Cup. I thought, you know, they took that place over then. And this time, instead of pale blue and white, it was taken over by dark blue and yellow. The clips I saw of them setting off flares on the beach, very neat, I must point out. Right, really, really good. That's organized flare setting off. That isn't just random. So, yeah, I did like that, as the sort of blue and yellow smoke version of their kit wafted along the beach. That was good. That just adds to the whole exoticism and spectacle of it all, I think. So this final then, Fluminense, and there's various players of European heritage, or not heritage, European careers who were featuring in this. We had Edinson Cavani and Sergio Romero, both former Manchester United, of course, and in Cavani's case, Napoli and so on. They were featuring for Boca, and we had Marcelo of Real Madrid, heroics gone days gone by in the Fluminense side. Fluminense, I guess, it's interesting when I say that that's the biggest one, probably not to have won it. And I guess in Rio, Flamengo dominates a lot. Fluminense is traditionally the club of the more well-to-do citizens of Rio. Whether that still applies or not these days, I'm not really sure, but that's how it sort of sprouted. It's probably similar to how River Plate began, being seen as the club of the better off, but now it's just that's not necessarily true. These two had they'd clashed in the quarterfinals about a decade ago with Boca coming out. Fluminense at this time had actually reached the final in slightly better style. They'd smashed River Plate in the group stages, and they'd come through the knockouts in decent style, whereas Boca, they'd been far narrower. They won all three knockout rounds on penalties, which is quite an achievement. And this final was not far off going to penalties either. It was a pretty good, tasty, feisty match. Who doesn't love that for a final? I think if we're going to get all stereotypical and cliched, if we're talking a big South American clash with the noise, the colour and all of that stuff, we're also talking a bit of aggro on the field, a bit of push and shove, a bit of argy-bargy and all of that stuff. And this game had plenty of that. It had terrific goals as well. A terrific goal apiece in normal time. So excuse all the pronunciations, but German Cano for Fluminense and then Luis Advíncula equalised with an even better strike for Boca in the second half. So it went to extra time and another terrific strike this time for Fluminense to win it in extra time. That was scored by the magnificently named John Kennedy, also known as Batista de Souza. I don't really know what's going on there, but hey, that's his Brazilian name. Is Batista de Souza becomes John Kennedy. We had a red card apiece as well, which, again, just perfect for a final. This is what you need. You want a bit of everything. Maybe an own goal is the only thing we were missing. John Kennedy, he earned one of these yellow cards for his celebrations of his about-to-be winning goal, running off towards the crowd or even into the crowd a bit. That got him his second yellow. But just as it seemed Fluminense would have to hold on with only 10 men, Boca managed to get a man sent off for slapping one of the Fluminense players. I mean, I don't know. You got to love it, though. Who does not love a final that gets tasty like this? So Fluminense, though, they held on. They won the Copa Libertadores for the first time. It was only their second final. They'd actually lost in 2008 on penalties to Quito, of all teams, a 5-5 aggregate draw, and that's the only ever Ecuadorian club to win. So the Fluminense, I guess, had a bit of a blockage to overcome, and they did it in fine style here. Equally, this is a tournament that for a long time in its past, if you run down the list of Libertadores winners over the year, you see the Argentinian flag again and again and again and again throughout its history, and they dominated it so much. But this is now 5 wins in a row for Brazilian clubs, which maybe it feels a bit odd that Brazilian clubs hadn't had quite as much glory in this historically as Argentinian ones had, but they're certainly getting it now. In terms of its importance, and this is where I kind of equally find it interesting from the South American perspective. Obviously, this puts Fluminense into the next World Club Cup, and for South Americans, that's a huge, huge deal. Equally for him, he's talked about this as being his most important title at club level. Now, considering he's won the lot with Real Madrid, I think that says a lot about what it means to South Americans, and particularly in this case for Fluminense, and for him, this is the club where he began his career, so it's obviously a big, big deal for him. It's all then rounded off with an absolutely stunning piece of silverware being lifted into the sky. And I think that, again, just adds to it all. We may think the European Cup looks great with its big ears, but this one tops it for me. But beyond that, it's just the setting of it all. The passion of the teams and fans alike, even if it overspills, it's great. And especially in the stands and terraces, the fans just add an extra dose of vibrancy and exoticism. But the knowledge of how much it means to everyone involved makes it great. So I enjoyed watching the bits of that I managed to see, sort of extended highlights rather than being able to watch it fully. You know, it was a terrific, terrific final. It's one I always look out for when there is coverage. Some years they've actually given us coverage of a few of the knockout rounds as well, but this time I think it was just the final. But it's one never to miss. I love watching it. I love the colours. I love the kits. I love the fans. I love it all. If that's not enough love, I don't know what is. It's a terrific final. I mean, did you guys manage to see any of it?
Yeah, I was watching some of it last night, and I echo those sentiments, and I think it had absolutely everything you could want from a final. You had the incredible stadium, like you say, the kits, the classic teams, and I think as the game went on and goes into extra time and, you know, a League One sounding player in John Kennedy or League Two, maybe even non-league player, steps up with the win. And the fact that he got sent off as well, celebrated the goal, I think
perfect.
It almost makes it even better and sort of more heroic that he scored and then, you know, gives up his place on the pitch, if you like. But it is one of those things where it's such an iconic tournament. And you look at, as you say, you look at the names of the winners from the past, that these are teams that are kind of etched into your memory as the biggest and the best that South America's got to offer. And I think for a team like Fluminense to win it this year is enormous for them. And it's such a moment for them. And I was reading a little bit, probably in the lead up to the game as well, about their coach and about kind of the style of football that he plays. And obviously he's interim manager at Brazil at the minute. And that kind of, you can read it as sort of anti-positional football or anti-Guardiola or anti-European football. And, you know, trying to bring back that style that Brazilians might have been known from years before. So I suppose it was fitting for them to win it, especially in the way that they got to the final. I know that Boca, I think, had not won any of the knockout games in normal time. It had all been through penalties. And the stat where the Fluminense top scorer had scored more goals individually than Boca had as a team in the whole tournament, I thought was another perfect stat to match along with the game.
It makes it feel like the right winner at the end then, doesn't it? Because if you've had that all the way through, it doesn't always work out that way. Sporting justice doesn't usually always pan out how we want, but in this case, I think it did.
Yeah, definitely. And I think especially the way Boca started the game, they were certainly on the back foot for quite a lot of the early stages. And I think that possibly maybe didn't come out of that part of the game or the style of they were playing, maybe looking for extra time and penalties, which, you know, they very nearly got in the end. What about you, Dave? Did you see any all or part of the game?
I caught up with the highlights early on. I mean, as Aidan says, the thing that grabs you is just the spectacle. You know, the stadium, the colour, there were three really great quality goals as well through the game. Terrific goals. And it's surprised that Fluminense had never won it before. You know, I mean, kind of one of those things that you know but don't know, if you know what I mean. Amazing that, you know, they are one of those names that you know from that part of the world over here. You know, you would have expected them to have had three or four trophies in the cabinet by now. But no, so that was interesting. And Aidan writes about the trophy. I mean, it's a terrific chunk of... I don't know what it is in the end. I mean, obviously, they put all the names of the winners on the sort of plinth thing at the bottom of the base. So in another 20 years, I don't know who's going to be able to pick that thing.
It reminds me, it's a bit like have you ever seen the Stanley Cup in ice hockey in North America? It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and soon they just won't be able to lift it. I think this is very much like that.
I thought it was nice as well that a fellow called John Kennedy had a good November for once.
Ooh. Very good.
Couldn't resist, so. But no, so, I mean, it's such a different feel to watching European finals. Even the great European stadiums, they don't have that same sort of colour to them that you got in that game last night. And I mean, even at the end, you know, it's just the big cliche, the confetti that comes down. But even that seemed different. I don't know whether it's, you know. Being in South America, and you're just predisposed to feel it a different kind of a way. But it was a magnificent spectacle, great goals, and you know I think it'd be one of those that'll go down in people's memories for a long time. I think it's one of those that'll endure. People will talk about it for years to come, I think.
Aidan, what do you think the sort of next thing or the legacy will be for Fluminense with a win like this? Is it kind of onwards and upwards from here, or is this the pinnacle of where they've got to?
You'd imagine in their case, well, this, I mean, this obviously is the pinnacle. They've never reached this high. And you'd love to think they'd be able to again. Obviously, even in their own city, they are some way behind the biggest club there. And obviously, they're therefore also the biggest club in their country. But I think this is a competition that there are a lot of ways, there are a lot of teams get into it. And I think it's still meritocracy, but I think it's slightly expanded meritocracy than we have in Europe, certainly for the clubs from the bigger countries. So there are more opportunities to get into it. I think it seems quite a lot of the time, once you're through to the knockouts, the games are relatively close much of the time, and that does open up the opportunity. What I think is really interesting in both these teams this year, so this applies to Boca as much as Fluminense, is that they've both got returning heroes, if you like, you know, the people who've served their time across in Europe but have come back, not necessarily always to their home club or one they've been before, but that very much was the case in Marcelo with Fluminense. And I think that's something that South American clubs would be well served to be, well, they probably are trying to do this more and more, but yeah, I think this is something that maybe it's South American players I should put this onto rather than the clubs, that to come back and give something back to the domestic game or back to the South American game. You know, they've earned their profile and they've gone off and earned their millions elsewhere at the bigger clubs in Europe. But, you know, they are South Americans. And if they want to be seen as part of the South American game, not a European construct, you know, some of these players have played their entire career across in Europe. Like I say, not necessarily the case for Marcelo, who'd begun and ended now with Fluminense, but it is the case with some. And I think for clubs like this, especially if they aren't necessarily the biggest, maybe Boca, River, Flamengo isn't quite the same because they can draw up all the talent that hasn't gone to Europe. But a club like Fluminense, if they can make use of players coming back, it's the club also Romario came back to, I think, as well at one stage. That's the kind of thing that could help nudge them on. It would bring greater interest. It'd also bring greater focus on things like the Brazilian Championship or Copa Libertadores in this case. So yeah, that's possibly a way I could see them pushing on further. It would be really interesting to see how they get on in the Champions League, especially what you were saying there, Rob, about their style compared to Guardiola's style. Well, who will they be up against? It's highly likely that the final, you know, the way these things generally pan out is that it'll be Fluminense against Manchester City. That will be a really interesting one to keep an eye on as well. And I'd certainly be in Fluminense's corner for that, if for no other reason than they have a far nicer kit. But equally, I think it's just nice to see the South Americans get one over the European counterparts in those things. I don't know how that'll all play out when the World Club Cup gets expanded yet further, thanks to Mr. Infantino. But that, again, might open the door to too many teams, and then clubs like this don't get the chance to reach that particular pinnacle. But we'll see this time around. But yeah, I think it would be great to think that they would push on and could reach this stage again. But it does seem that the people winning it several times in a row isn't necessarily a thing in these competitions. It's as much in Europe as South America. It's very, very hard to do. So we may not see them back at this just straight away, but I think it would be really, really intriguing to see how they get on in the World Club Cup. And I would love to see them lift that as well.
Yeah, I think that'll be great to actually maybe bring this back to the podcast when it actually happens, that World Club Championships, to look at some of the different styles of the teams that are in there, especially hopefully not every team in it will be owned by a City group or the like, but you never know. Sticking with the cup theme, Dave, you're going to tell us a little bit about maybe something not quite as exotic as the Copa Libertadores final at the Maracanã, but the Scottish League Cup. Maybe how we could learn from it in England.
Yeah, it's a bit more meat and potatoes, or meats and tatties, I think, the Scottish League Cup than the Copa Libertadores. Yeah, the semi-finals are over the weekend, one on each day at Hampden Park. We've emerged with Aberdeen Rangers as the final. Aberdeen played Hibs yesterday, and Hibs have got to feel pretty hard done by, to be perfectly honest. I mean, they were the better team for much of the game. Aberdeen went down to 10 with about 20 minutes to go, and then lo and behold, on the break, scored and held out to win the game. I do a bit of work for Aberdeen, so I was delighted, obviously. But I mean, I think Barry Robson, the manager, made a good point after the game. It is very difficult for Aberdeen this season, and it's a great achievement to reach the final, because, I mean, they'd played four games in the last 9 days, where Hibs had played twice because of the European stuff. And I think for a Scottish team, that does qualify for the group stages. And obviously, this doesn't apply so much to Rangers and Celtic, but for the third Scottish team that qualifies for the group stages, it's incredibly difficult to maintain any kind of, you know, competitive edge in Europe and go through the League Cup and still compete in the league up until Christmas. It's very, very difficult. Because, I mean, you know, you can't build a squad in the same sense that we see in England. Because if you don't get back into that group stage the following year, then you've got all these players that you can't afford, basically, and who aren't going to play. So I think in that sense, Aberdeen have done a really good job to get to the final. And then today it was more expected, I suppose, Rangers coming through against Hearts, and Rangers having had the change of manager over the last few weeks, like a whole different prospect. And I think you would have to have them as the favourites for the cup final. And the interesting thing is that cup final is the Sunday before Christmas, the 17th of December. So they in Scotland, they get the League Cup out of the way nice and early in the season. And obviously there's fewer teams involved in the League Cup up there. It's not the 92 that's involved here. It's what, 40 teams, I think it is. 48 teams. But, I mean, they do it in a really interesting way. They essentially, pre-season in Scotland becomes the League Cup group stages. So all the teams other than the ones that are playing in Europe have to play in the group stages to qualify, which makes for some, you know, unusual results. I mean, Stirling Albion beat St Johnstone 4-0, I think it was, at one point in the group stages. So while everybody's trying to find their feet and so on, it makes it quite interesting. And also, as somebody who's had to go to many pre-season friendlies from a work basis, I can't understand why anybody would want to go to a pre-season friendly. The most tedious, pointless things in the, yeah, on God's earth. But at least if you're doing it as in the guise of a League Cup, then you've got something to it. You know, there's a bit of an edge to it. So I think that's quite a nice thing. And I wonder if in England, you know, the group stage thing isn't going to work. But I don't know if we could maybe bring the League Cup in. So that's the 2 weeks before the start of the league season. You know, and you can sort of winnow down a few of the teams at that point. You get in a bit of an edge to the games. Nobody takes the League Cup seriously in this country anyway until they get to the final stage. So I don't know that they would be too bothered about that. And I think it makes a nice, it brings the first half of the season to a nice sort of crescendo, having the League Cup final at Hampden on the 17th. And, you know, there's no real reason why we couldn't do that in England, to be perfectly honest. As I say, I know there's more teams and so on. But, I mean, we've got to the quarterfinal stages now in the League Cup. It's not beyond the wit of man that we could have had that a couple of weeks earlier, played some of that in July. And then that gives the League Cup a real focus, because it just sort of ambles on, doesn't it? And then all of a sudden after Christmas, you've got to the home and away semi-final stage and the final. And it's kind of a, by that point, you're into the thick of the Champions League, you're into the thick of the league season. Everybody's worried about whether they're going up or going down, you know. And it just kind of gets brushed to one side, I think. Whereas if you were able to bring it to that kind of focus, if you were, you know, whoever gets to the League Cup final, Newcastle are there again this year, you know, you could be ambling down to Wembley the Sunday before Christmas, Aiden, do a bit of shopping in the morning, off to Wembley Stadium in the afternoon. Perfect for the day.
Pitch it as a Christmas shopping trip. Yeah.
So I just wonder if that might be one way of kind of giving it a bit more of a focus and a bit more of an impetus in this country, rather than it being the poor relation all the while.
I think it's a brilliant idea, and I think that obviously, even though there's more teams in England that would potentially be in the cup, you could just remove the Premier League from that first stage. So you've just got the three, you know, the Championship, League One, League Two. You could put everybody together. It probably means that because a lot of teams now, especially at Championship and below, are staying in this country for friendlies, a lot of them are playing Championship, League One, League Two opposition anyway. So why not make it a competitive game instead? You know, the Premier League teams can go off on their tours of America and Australia and Asia and wherever they normally go to, while competitive football is happening in this country. I actually think it would probably work quite well. I don't see a problem with it apart from, you know, the Papa John's or Johnson's Paint or whatever kind of trophy you want to call it. But I think, you know, other football league teams would probably much rather be part of maybe a more competitive competition, shall we say, against some of the bigger teams from the Championship than having to play, you know, the under-23s from Liverpool and Manchester City and Manchester United, where maybe it doesn't feel to them like it's exactly what they want to be involved in. And I think there's been conversations about what that looks like from a long-term point of view. And then obviously you bring the big boys in the knockout rounds and whatever else. But Aidan, what do you think, you know, as a supporter of a relatively large Premier League club, what do you think the ramification that would be for a Premier League team? There probably wouldn't be that many, but is it something you can see possibly being suggested by them to sort of change the way the structure of the competition is?
Yeah, just jotting some things down when Dave was talking there. Firstly, I guess the thought of having it, I don't want to say out of the way by the end of the year, because that doesn't sound very positive, but built to a crescendo before the end of the year, that seems to me a really, really a positive idea, because currently we have the semi-finals in January over two legs and the finals sort of late February. That's a time where we don't have European football, but the FA Cup is underway. And also the league season is just building and building and building. You know, this is nothing that ever really concerned me until last year. I didn't really have much much say in the latter stages of a League Cup. You'd have more experience of that, Rob, than I would from Borough. But I think it feels a little bit like you're just storing up problems for the teams that reach the latter stages, because their league games are impacted. And that seems almost like a punishment for having got far when it happens at that stage of the season, when it could have been dealt with earlier. So from that perspective, I think it would be a real positive to have it wrapped up by mid-December. I think the other issue, of course, is the clash with midweek European games. Now, they are going to be getting more and more from next season with the crazy champions in inverted comma Swiss style league that I really don't understand, and hopefully one of you guys will explain it all next season so I can really get to grips with how they work out who plays who and all of that stuff. But if that's going to be taking up more midweeks, what is the impact on League Cup? Maybe the impact is it does have to come early, like Dave's saying, and you have to get more out of the way early. Maybe that'll work for the better. Currently, the teams who qualified for Europe don't enter until the third round, with the rest of the top flight and much of the championship coming in the second round, I think. Potentially, the only way would be to make it, I think you mentioned this, to make all Premier League teams not come until the third round, perhaps, to reduce the number of match days that are required for the teams that will be in those stages. Possibly that's a way. Group stage would be interesting as well. I've always found that odd at domestic club level, because simply it just doesn't happen in my experience, but obviously it does happen in Scotland. It's an interesting one, but as you say, I don't think that's something that would necessarily work. In England, there'd be an awful lot of groups and it would just seem a bit weird. It's far easier just to get one game done and half the field straight away. But overall, I think it's quite positive. I think the problem will be European dates, and that's maybe, I mean, you can't have it that the European clubs get pushed back to a fourth round, because then they're almost in the final already. You're just skewing it even more in their favour than it already is, which I don't think is right. Yeah, that's the biggest drawback I can see. But I don't like it dragging into January and February, because the cup has moved on to something else, and it impacts on the league for those teams involved.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And as a Borough fan whose team has just got into the quarterfinals of the Carabao Cup, I think that it feels exciting, because you've got that sort of cup game to look forward to every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks or whatever it is. And you're kind of in the swing of it. I mean, if we are lucky enough to get to a semi-final, that's a long old wait for us to actually get to that point. And I think this is the last year of the two-legged semi-finals as well. So there's already plans for the following year to only have one knockout game in that sense. So you're losing a match from that point of view. I mean, I'm not sure whether it's going to be held at Wembley, but I thought that could be another option that they use to try and link it to what the FA Cup do as well. But it does feel like you get this momentum behind you that you especially when our league form was dire, shall we say. You always had the cup to fall back on, that you were going to have a positive performance, you might get a good result, you might get into playing a bigger team in the next round. So I think that element of moving it further forward, and apparently everybody loves football at Christmas, so why not add in a trip to Wembley at Christmas for two teams? which kind of seems like a bit of a no-brainer. Fixture congestion is always one that is probably never going to be solved because nobody will ever decide that they don't want to do something, I think is the biggest problem, isn't it, Dave? And I think obviously Scotland have decided we need to get this sorted out early so that we can probably help our teams later on. I was looking at the page for the competition. The quarterfinals at the end of September, you know, which we're just going to get to in a couple of weeks in England. Again, I know we said a smaller amount of teams, but it certainly is that element of we need to make a change. It needs to happen sooner. Let's put it in place, isn't it?
We're coming to a point, I think, where maybe we just say the teams that have qualified for Europe don't play in the League Cup anymore each season. Because, you know, we talk about fixture congestion. And yes, if you are Manchester City or, you know, Liverpool or Newcastle or whatever, you have got fixture congestion because you've qualified for the Champions League or the group stages of, you know, whichever European competition it is. But the rest of the teams are sitting around not doing anything. So, you know, you're all playing on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Burnley are sitting at home doing nothing when they could be playing cup football. So, you know, I wonder if there's, I know that there's the issues with Europe that they don't like you playing any domestic competitions while they're playing their competitions and all those sorts of rules. But, you know, I wonder if that's perhaps the way around it, that if you qualify for Europe, you miss out on the League Cup. I mean, I'm sure that the likes of Guardiola and Arteta wouldn't be, you know, overly concerned if they ended up missing out on those games. And also then it gives somebody outside the norm a chance to qualify for Europe if you still keep a Europa League place or a Conference League place as the League Cup winner. So I think, you know, there's plenty of ways around it. It just always seems to me that the entire game, you know, there's 92 clubs in the English game, and we're all held to ransom about fixture congestion by the fact that seven teams are in Europe, you know, which seems a bit unfair to say the least. I mean, it's a bit, you know, a bit stacked in favour of just a few clubs. So, you know, maybe that's an opportunity to get around it. Maybe that would be something that would revitalise the League Cup. I mean, the irritating thing about the League Cup, most of all, is that Manchester City couldn't care less. Arsenal couldn't care less. And they always win the damn thing anyway. You know, that. So if they don't want to play, go, okay, don't play. And then let's put some new names on it. That'd be interesting.
On that, Dave, it's a nice idea, but would the qualification for European competition have to get taken away or get taken away if all of the clubs weren't in it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a reasonable point, I think. But by and large, the League Cup is still won by the teams that already qualify for Europe anyway, in the Champions League and the whatever. So, yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't know if that's necessarily a thing. I'm sure there would be arguments about it, absolutely for sure. But it might be the one way of making it work, I think.
I think the League Cup also shows the continuing gap between the top and the rest. So I think maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it was very different teams in the final year on year. Other teams had a bigger opportunity of actually getting to a final and winning it because, you know, the competitive balance was probably a little bit more equal than it is now. And I think what is very difficult is, you know, if you don't support one of the clubs who've got a super squad, they play, you know, a mixed team until the quarterfinals and then the semifinals, the big boys come in. But they've still kept the goalkeeper the same, everybody. We've still got our reserve goalkeeper in, you know, the spirit of the competition. And then they play all their big guns for the semis and the final. And then obviously it becomes more like a top-end Premier League game, doesn't it? There's an interesting thing that's happening in the NBA at the moment with like fixture game schedules. They play 82 games. Now, I'm not suggesting that we start playing that many games, but they've started to put a limit on how many games you have to play to qualify for certain awards, like individual awards. So you have to play at least 65 games to qualify to be MVP. Maybe you say that to some of the bigger clubs in the cup competitions that they need to play more of their players who played some of the most minutes or something like that to kind of make them play those players earlier on. But then maybe they just win earlier on and it ends up being Man United, Liverpool, Newcastle, Chelsea, Arsenal, Brighton in the last eight anyway. So you're kind of on a bit of hides. And I think your point, Aidan, about maybe taking the European qualification away, part of me, I mean, whether it's allowed or not within the rules, part of me would keep it in. Because if you were allowed to, it means that at least you know that one of those teams that might not be competing at the top six, top eight, at least would have the opportunity to get into Europe and win a trophy. Because I think now, if you know you can't win the league, but you're probably going to finish in the top six, European football is like a trophy now. Probably changed, didn't it, in the early 2000s. And it is a shame that that's happened. And maybe that's where we need a bit of change at the EFL Cup. But, you know, we're probably not known for forward thinking, are we, as the football nation with our competitions. Okay, moving on from those cup jaunts, I would like to bring Harry Kane to the table. So, a man who had been criticised for not winning trophies or being part of a team who struggled to win trophies. I think people probably blamed Harry Kane for Spurs not winning trophies even before he played for them. But obviously, in the Premier League, he was one of the top strikers. He probably could have broken Alan Shearer's record at the rate he was going. Tottenham, obviously, have now got an even more offensive coach in Ange Postecoglou. So, there might have been even more opportunity for him to do that. But instead, he's moved to Germany, to the Bundesliga, and he's currently scoring at an incredible rate for Bayern Munich, so much so that if he carried on at this rate, he possibly would beat the record in a season, which was set by Robert Lewandowski a couple of years ago. He scored 41 goals in a season. So at the minute, Harry Kane has got 15 goals and 5 assists, and he's only started 10 games. So, I mean, it's a pretty incredible record already. The fact that it doesn't seem to matter who he plays against, he just scores goals. And I think we've always known that Harry Kane scores goals. And he's been a brilliant goal scorer all the way through his career. And at 30 years old, he's probably been at his peak for, I mean, 5, 6, 7 years. It doesn't really seem like there's been that much of a drop-off. Fortunately for him, he's had a pretty good record with injuries as well. So, for me, I suppose, one of the things looking at Kane is, and you can see the sort of criticisms already starting to seep in, that he's gone to a league that's far too easy for him. He's gone to a league that is not providing him with competition. He'd scored 30 goals in the Premier League last season. Why does he need to move if he's got such a great record? Doesn't he want to score more goals? He was at 213 Premier League goals. Shearer, I think, was at 260. So, again, not too far away, maybe a couple of seasons away. His move to Germany may well bring him silverware. It won't be in the cup because obviously Bayern got knocked out by a third tier side, which was quite funny. But obviously they are competing for the Champions League. And I think that's obviously one of Kane's main reasons in moving to Bayern, in that he's gone to a team that is going to qualify for the Champions League year in, year out. And he probably knows he needs 3 or 4 good years at that level, possibly to cement his legacy as one of the best English strikers. I possibly disagree with that myself, because I do think he's already up there just on the goals that he scored, especially with the team that he's playing for. Could he have moved to a side like Manchester United? Well, he's probably really, really pleased he didn't move to Manchester United based on their current performances this season and sort of the dysfunctional nature of what the club is like at the moment. But I suppose why I wanted to bring this up was, can Harry Kane still be really, really good in a league that isn't as strong as the Premier League and still have that legacy in his future? Are we so bothered about the quality of the leagues and how many goals you score and how many teams would do well in the Premier League and all that kind of stuff, when actually you just judge the fact that he's gone to an enormous club with an enormous amount of pressure and scored an enormous amount of goals already this season and doesn't show any signs of stopping? He's fit into that team perfectly. The other players around him are sort of really feeding off him and into him. And I think he's really fit in well with Tuchel's system. Aidan, do you think, I suppose what I'm kind of saying is, do you think it's been a bit of a mistake for Harry Kane to move to a league like the Bundesliga, which is known for quite offensive football, maybe not the best defensive systems in Europe? And will that tarnish whatever it is, that he achieves by the end of his career?
Certainly not in my mind. No, I think it's an absolutely brilliant move for him to make. I think clearly it's on the one hand showing that it's easier to score goals in the Bundesliga. He's just scoring at a ridiculous rate. But not everybody scores like this. He it takes a great player to be able to do it. He seems a player reborn. I think he's been freed up. This interminable discussion of where he would go next, the on-off thing with Manchester City the other year, speculation about Manchester United this year, whether he would stay at Tottenham, whether Tottenham would be able to achieve the ambitions that he might have personally. It must have been weighing him down. And I think he, in his style, it seemed to have been coming more and more withdrawn on positionally on the field, trying to get more involved. And I think that came from the fact that there was so much bearing down on him from all those aspects, all that speculation, all the issues that Tottenham were having. And he seems invigorated now. He seems freed. And I really, really like that. I'm of the opinion that people who broaden their horizons, it's generally a good thing. And in life as much as in football. And I think for Harry Kane, Premier League record is, well, it's a scoring record. To me, as a guy from who remembers the 80s well, I know for a fact, obviously, that Alan Shearer scored a hatful of goals before the Premier League. So, you know, his total isn't even his own personal total. And equally, he's way down the list of overall top scorers in English top flight football. So I feel a bit curmudgeonly about that being mentioned as a reason for Kane to want to stay. I'm glad that he didn't because of that. He may well come back for a couple of years later in his career and beat Shearer's Premier League record anyway. But in the meantime, he's now given himself the chance to reach the latter stages, well, win some silverware, but reach the latter stages of the Champions League regularly, as you say. And in terms of how his reputation, coming back to your question, how that will sit, I think it's in Europe where that will be decided. And therefore, he's now given himself far better opportunity to be regularly in the latter stages of European competition. Sure, he's played in a final once for Tottenham already, but Tottenham are far less likely to be involved in the latter stages of the Champions League than Bayern Munich. That's just simple truth. So I think it's there that his legacy will be forged. That's where the success or otherwise of his move to Germany will be fully judged. If he does happen to break Lewandowski's record or even come close to it, because it's quite an astonishing record that he achieved a couple of years ago, that would obviously go some way to doing so as well. It's interesting from the Premier League perspective that Son seems to have been freed and is enjoying life very much at Tottenham as well. I mean, they always work really, really well together. They're a great combination, but the lack of Kane has seen Son step up even more. And obviously playing under an attacking manager helps. But equally, there's a lot of crap in the Premier League as well. You know, it does get described as the toughest league, the strongest league and all, whatever. And maybe that's true for the top teams. But if you spread that out, then, you know, it's leagues within a league, isn't it? And the bottom of the league, there's an awful lot of dross, despite how much money they have and how much is spent. So is scoring a hatful against Bochum or whoever that different to scoring them against Burnley? I don't know. But I think for Kane, this is a terrific opportunity. I'm really, really pleased. I was so, following it over the summer, I was just really, really hoping he would go and that he wouldn't just decide, oh yes, I'll stay and become a Tottenham legend even more and get Premier League records or whatever. Well, for what? I mean, Tottenham aren't going to win it. Probably. They're doing rather well this year, but they're probably not going to win it. They are very unlikely to get to a Champions League final again in the next few years. I say very unlikely. They have been to one relatively recently, but it, you know, that isn't so likely to be repeated compared to many of the other clubs involved. And therefore, why on earth not? It's given them a new lease of life, and I'm all for it. And if you look at the other end of the age scale of professional footballers, of Jude Bellingham flourishing in Real Madrid, the prospect of Bellingham in behind Kane, who's not being more withdrawn on the pitch and staying up front and full of confidence, that's an enticing one from an English perspective as well. And we'll see how that plays out. But no, I think it's a terrific move. I'm delighted he went there. You can just see he's absolutely loving life in Munich. And good for him. And I'm really pleased. I think his legacy will be decided in Europe, though.
Yeah, I think I agree. And the point you make about the competitive balance or competitive edge that the Premier League may or may not have is quite interesting when you compare someone like Erling Haaland, who scores at a similar rate to Harry Kane in Germany. And in England, Harry Kane's scoring rate was not too bad at all, let's be brutally honest. maybe not a goal every game like Haaland, but certainly someone like Haaland who does seem to score a lot of goals against teams that may be weaker than the top six. And I think that might be more apparent that we've seen recently. It's interesting how our perceptions of our own league kind of insinuate that Haaland maybe should have won the Ballon d'Or over someone like Lionel Messi, whereas we see one of our own doing it in another league and maybe we're a little bit too quick to put them down. Dave, Harry Kane is going to score goals wherever he goes, and he's obviously proved to do it a lot of Bayern. Do you think, like Aidan says, this has been a perfect move for him, sort of broadening his horizons and getting out there?
We weren't talking about the Bundesliga being a load of rubbish and we were using it to pick up Jude Bellingham over the last 2 years. You know, I mean, we were saying, oh, what a marvellous job he's doing going abroad and proving himself to be a world-class footballer. So, I mean, I think, you know, Kane is one of those classic victims of his own success. He makes the job look too easy. And by doing that, people think, oh, well, he's only playing against rubbish, isn't he? Obviously, he's a fantastic goal scorer. He's a proper one of the pantheon of great English strikers. Yeah. I mean, he's got the England scoring record and all of that. So, you know, I mean, the only thing that was missing from his career was medals, which clearly he's going to rectify that this season. I mean, you know, you go back to Kevin Keegan when he went to Hamburg. I mean, he came back a better player for having played in a different country. And that's not necessarily about the comparative standards of the leagues or whatever. But it's playing in a different setting. It's playing in a different country. It's, you know, having to adapt to a different culture, to, you know, to different expectations, and all of those things. Particularly, I mean, Kane's what he's around 30 now. I mean, he could have stayed at Tottenham forever and been the legend and all of that, and never have tested himself. Whereas this, okay, you are going to Bayern Munich, so you know you are going to the best team in the country. And all of that, but you know you've got to fit in with a new language, a new culture, a different manager, different expectations, all of that sort of stuff. It's a challenge, and you know he could very easily have ignored that and just you know carried on till he packed up at Spurs and all that. But I think you know good for him that he went and did all of this. I think it's you know it's only credit to him. And I also think you know I think we mentioned this in podcasts before, but I think it's good for Tottenham as well actually because I think. He became bigger than the football club. Everything that Tottenham was about Harry Kane. And that's not a good situation for any football club to be. You can't have an individual player who's bigger than everything. So everything, if there was a problem at Spurs, it had to be Harry Kane that solved it. If we got the ball, we had to find Harry Kane. You know, everything was about Harry Kane all the time. If he missed three or four games with injury, oh my God, what are Spurs going to do? You know. I think now it's giving them a different. I think for Postecoglou, it's a great thing that he's come in and been able to build his own team without having this. Well, he's the man, and you've got to make everything else function around it. He's been able to do his own thing, build the team the way he wants, and Spurs have benefited from it, and Harry Kane's benefited from it. I think it was the perfect move. I think it would have been really dull if he just stayed in England and played for you know one of the obvious clubs. In this country, what would that have told us? What would that have told him about himself? I think the challenge is important. To do it at that stage of his career, I think he's brave. And he's obviously making the absolute most of it.
Yeah, and do you know what? He's just a great player to watch. He's just absolutely. Really enjoyable to watch play football. And that Bayern Munich team is a really fun team to watch as well. And I know that they're hoping that they can go far in the Champions League. They've got the squad depth, I think, to take them to that position. I hope he does really well. I'm definitely one for our players, our English players, getting out there, going abroad, playing for these other big clubs. I think more and more should do it. And hopefully, younger players seeing people like Sancho, maybe not so much now, but obviously when he'd left City and went to Dortmund and had some success. You've got Bellingham doing it at Real Madrid. There's also a whole host of youngsters. Callum Hudson-Odoi, I think, had a loan spell at Bayer Leverkusen as well. So getting these young players out there to expand their horizons and play different types of football, adjust to a different lifestyle, I think is a real positive. But maybe someone who is not adjusting to the lifestyle of the English Premier League is Erik ten Hag at Manchester United. Aidan, you would like to talk to us about Erik ten Hag and maybe where the Premiership manager sack race may heat up over the next few weeks.
Well, yes, there's two sides to this. I mean, firstly, on the sack race, I think it's quite interesting, and obviously, you know, this is as much a Sky Sports News and betting industry thing, I guess, as much as anything else. But the whole sack race, the fact that nobody's been sacked and we're now in November, is unusual. Last season, 13 Premier League managers were sacked, the first of which was in August, Scott Parker. He basically signed his own death warrant, but he was swiftly followed by Thomas Tuchel a few weeks later. In fact, Chelsea got rid of another one by the end of the year, I think. You know, there was a lot, whereas this season we haven't had any. Now, I guess at the minute it's possibly a race between Erik ten Hag and Paul Heckenbottom, or maybe even Mauricio Pochettino, the way things are going at Chelsea. But to focus on ten Hag, he seems very, very much on borrowed time. I think, in cliche alert, I think he's lost the dressing room. The squad seemed to be in open conflict at times. I don't know that the win they had over Fulham this weekend necessarily changes anything. I think they got quite fortunate in winning late on. I guess it helps that Bruno Fernandes is doing well and scored the goal. They seem to have had a bit of a public support for each other. The writing still, I think, is on the wall. I think there's too much has gone wrong for it to come back. And what intrigues me, I guess, equally is those in charge of how they view things. Because if the writing seems on the wall to so many other people speculating, what are they thinking behind the scenes? Sometimes the clubs let it go too long, and then the malaise is set in too deep and it's harder for people to turn around. I know we're not at the late stage of a season where I guess clubs who are down at the lower reaches might think of changing manager to reinvigorate and try and survive. But sometimes clubs leave it a little bit too long. I think that can be the case near the top as well. It's a timing thing, but of course, I guess you need to have the right person to take over as well. And that's something Manchester United has seemingly struggled with ever since Ferguson left. It's been a poison chalice for many people with great reputations. And Erik ten Hag came with a strong reputation. You know, it all seemed quite good initially, the way, you know, he came in with a strong track record, good ideals, strong identity of how he liked to play. He dealt with the whole Ronaldo situation well, got rid of someone who was becoming a bit of a drain on the club and the team. But now it all seems a bit of a shambles. And like I say, the squad seems to be an open rebellion. I wonder how many of the players secretly are backing Jadon Sancho in his stance, hoping that it assists bringing about Ten Hag's downfall and then they all get a fresh start. Is Sancho equally clinging on to his position, refusing to apologise or refusing to sort of try and build a bridge in the belief that Ten Hag will be gone and he can make his return then? It's intriguing. The sort of club politics that must be at play here. And this also must come into the thinking of how things play out. Usually in these situations, it's not the players who take the hit, it's the manager. Now, I guess as an aside on that, I think Jadon Sancho, though, is probably damaging his own reputation as well, reducing his options going forward, but maybe he's just banking all on a change at Manchester United. In echoes of Penny Mordaunt's recent bizarre stand-up and fight speech at a Tory party conference, I think Ten Hag keeps going on and on and on about being a fighter and how the players want to fight for the team and how he wants to fight for his position. But I do wonder also that if a manager keeps on insisting that he's up for the fight in this kind of situation, are they always the last ones to realise that the fight is actually already over? Because they're so sort of stuck in their mind that I'm going to stay and fight. But actually, the situation is beyond that. I obviously saw them, how they played in the Carabao Cup in midweek against Newcastle. They were seemingly, well, they were awful, frankly, and seemingly without identity. You know, Newcastle played a vastly changed team as well. They seemed to have about 6 fullbacks on the field at one point. But, you know, there was a lot of changes. But as a team, they retained their identity and their style and their approach, no matter who the players who were on the field. Whereas Manchester United, they seemingly had no idea that such a thing was even a concept, let alone showed it in the game. And this is all on the manager and how everything's been worked on in training, how things are structured, how things are set, how the ideas are clear to everybody. If you make changes in the team and all that stays the same, sure, quality may drop off, but the actual approach and identity remains the same. That shows it's been fully ingrained across the board in the club. Manchester United have none of that. There's equally been a load of high profile or some high profile expensive signings on Ten Hag's watch, his recommendations from his past and so on, and they're simply failing. Other players are just getting worse. Sancho, we talked about, Maguire as well, Marcus Rashford now, who wasn't in the squad to play Fulham at the weekend. So to come back to the start of it, I think it's odd and unusual that there haven't been any sackings yet. I would be surprised if that continues on for too much longer, but you never know with some of the things. It may be somebody who takes us by surprise and not Ten Hag who's the first to go. But he's the one certainly facing all the pressure now. But for me, Manchester United, for all that they're still relatively high in the league and doing okay, they're so far adrift of where they actually want to be and where they see themselves and where their level of finance and investment probably dictates they ought to be able to compete, that the way it's all slightly chaotic, disorganized, disintegrating in a lot of ways, should be sounding lots of alarm bells there. And maybe there are talks going on behind the scenes and finding a successor before they bin off the current guy. But they've chopped and changed so many times now over the years and struggled to find the right answer since Ferguson left. He's casting a very, very long shadow considering he left over a decade ago now. Are they searching for somebody who is going to be of that ilk and dominate a club in such a way, or are they just searching for temporary solutions? I don't know. That's a sort of structural fundamental identity issue, but I think it's impacting so much on how the team plays that they're struggling for an answer. But I don't think that Ten Hag, as much as he seemed the answer a while ago, he doesn't look it anymore. I think he's not long for that team, I don't think.
I think United have become this Frankenstein's monster of a football team, haven't they, with their sort of stadium that was once the greatest in the country that's now kind of cobbled together with a bit of sticky tape. And I think the team is a representation of four or five different managers who've got different personalities, who wanted different things. And I think one of the things that maybe has been underestimated by the football side off the pitch at United is that someone like Klopp at Liverpool or Guardiola at City, even though they are the club, they are the man, they also have an elite football department off the field. So whether you say that, you know, Klopp is the man who's giving it fist bumps to the Anfield Road end, or Guardiola is the man who reinvented football, or whatever we think about those two managers, they also had all the right people off the pitch moving in the right direction. And I think the point you made, Aidan, about Newcastle, they are all moving in the right direction. Often that means around the other team's 18-yard box, because that Newcastle press at the minute is one of the best things that we've seen for a while in the Premier League. I think it's just fantastic. And the fact that you could make changes in the week, still see that in action, really does highlight what a good job Newcastle are doing in terms of Eddie Howe on the pitch, Dan Ashworth off the pitch, and how trying to unite those two things is really what needs to happen. And I wonder if there's a little bit of a link with managers not being sacked and those things. So, for example, Burnley, any other season, probably someone like Vincent Kompany would have been, you know, in the papers every other day that his job's under threat. But I think there's probably a little bit of unity off the pitch with what's going on the pitch. I saw an interview with Craig Bellamy done with Gary Neville, and Neville said, well, when are you going to change? When is your team going to change? And he said, we're not changing, we just need to be better. And I think there's a little bit of an attitude maybe towards those teams that are at the bottom end of the league, know they're going to get a lot of money for being in the Premier League, and maybe doing it the same way more often and better is the way to do it, rather than bringing in the man who's going to save you for 8 months and then possibly put you back in the same situation again. Dave, the sack race is non-existent at the moment in the Premier League. Maybe a couple of people heads on the block. Ten Hag certainly a forerunner for that. Do you think this is symptomatic of the club, or is it more of a bigger issue of what's gone on over the last 10 years at United rather than just Ten Hag's reign?
I think there's something fundamentally wrong there, and I think you have to go back to the Glazers taking it over. Ever since that happened, it hasn't really operated properly. And I think, you know, you look at the last few years of Ferguson's time there and what he managed to do in the last three or four seasons with all the passing time just looks more and more impressive, you know, to rank with all the other things that he did. But I think I mean, you can't keep harking back to a different time and to what Ferguson did and all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, you know, as Aidan says, when it comes to an argument with the players and the manager, or, you know, the players always win. Well, they never used to win under Alex Ferguson. You know, when Paul Ince got too big for his boots, Paul Ince was gone, Yap Stam was gone, David Beckham was gone. There was nobody bigger than Manchester United. You know, going back to what we were just saying about Harry Kane. The fundamental thing was the football club, and the bloke was in charge, and that was, you know, you worked for the football club or you went. You know, you did the right thing or you went. That doesn't seem to be the case at Manchester United anymore. And I mean, yeah, they did seem to have made some progress. Last season, you know, they qualified for the Champions League. They seem to be taking some steps in the right direction. And then this year, it's just unravelled spectacularly again, which seems to have happened, you know, two or three times at United. I mean, Solskjaer, in his first year, seemed to be moving things in the right direction. And then all the wheels fell off the bus. And it seems to be happening again. And I don't know. The leadership and the management at Manchester United doesn't make a great deal of sense to me. I mean, they've had now three interim managers. They've sacked a manager at this time of the year, December, February, January, whatever. And then, you know, a club like Manchester United should then say, OK, we've got rid of him. We'll go and get whoever our next manager is. But they don't. I mean, they had Ryan Giggs for 10 games after David Moyes. They had Solskjaer as an interim manager for a period. And OK, then he got the job full-time, but that wasn't the plan. Rangnick had the job for, you know, a few months. If you're Manchester United and you get rid of your manager, surely you just say, right, well, he's the one, we're going to get him. And, you know, whether he's at Bayern Munich, whether he's at Newcastle, whether he's at, you know, whatever club it's at, you just go and get him because you're Manchester United. And they don't seem to understand that anymore either. They don't. As I say, with every passing minute, Alex Ferguson looks greater and greater and greater, all the things that he did at Manchester United. And he was always going to be a difficult act to replace and all that sort of stuff. But they made a spectacular mess of it, and they continue to make a spectacular mess of it. And they don't seem any further forward now than they were when David Moyes was in charge, 10 years on, and God knows how many hundreds of millions of pounds spent. It's just an absolute shambles. But it's, you know, this season it seems to have come from nowhere, because they did, at the end of last season, they looked like they'd made a bit of progress, didn't they? I think most of us thought that this year, okay, they're not going to win the league, but they're going to be in the top four again, and, you know, they'll do all right, they'll have a decent season, and they're edging gradually forward. I mean, okay, you get rid of Ten Hag, what do you do then? Of course, everybody's going to want the Manchester United job, because it's Manchester United. You can still go and get whoever you want, pretty much. But why would anybody believe it's going to get any better? However good your manager is, you've still got to have all those things, as you say, Rob, in place off the pitch, all the support systems. And they don't appear to have any of that. Or if they do, it's certainly not working and they want to change him. So I don't see where Manchester United go. I don't see who they get, what the plan is. They just seem a shambles.
Do you think he'll be the first man to go, Dave, the first manager to go in the league?
It's a good question. I mean, I suppose part of it this season is that most teams are in the kind of place where you'd expect them to be. So, you know, the three at the bottom, kind of, well, that's what you'd expect. And after those guys got them up, why would you necessarily change? You know, they're expecting to go down. Two or three changes in the summer and are doing moderately. There was a season about 7 or 8 years ago where I think we got to Christmas before they sacked anybody. And then, of course, in the new year, it all went mental. It may be like that again. I mean, you'd have to say that Ten Hag was probably the favourite at this point to go. But he might be kept in a job simply by the fact of, well, OK, it's easy to sack somebody. Then what do you do? And that's what Manchester United in particular have done too often. Right, well, everybody's fed up with him, we'll sack him. And now what?
Do you think that's the case, Aidan, that Ten Hag might well be the first one to go?
I would think so. Purely because of the status of that club and how they're struggling. I guess I do wonder how Chelsea's position will go as well, though, considering how much money they've poured in and how they are still in as dire position as they were last year, only they now have what many would have regarded as one of the best managers around. But, you know, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, or whatever the saying is. You know, it's again, that's structural, fundamental identity issues of an owner who just wants to disturb the normal way of doing things and just sign people on these ridiculous long contracts, financially trying to make the numbers appear a certain way because of that, but buying in all these young players who don't have any experience to go with it and don't have the people at the club to direct them that way. And they're struggling. Will they, as a club, see that as Pochettino's fault? I don't know. The pressure doesn't seem to be on him just yet, but I do wonder how that'll go now that they have a very big name manager who still can't make the club a top half team, which is odd considering how much they've spent. But no, I think unless Sheffield United ditch Paul Heckenbottom, then Ten Hag is the most likely, because of it's not just performances on the field, it's all the drama that seems to be going on behind the scenes. There seems to be so much confusion, so much revolt, so many arguments going on that you just can't see that you can ever get back from that, even if the results can paper over the cracks a little bit, which is, I think, what's happened this weekend with the win over Fulham. Once those fault lines are established, they rarely get repaired.
Yeah, I think I probably tend to agree with that. And certainly wins do help, but when you look at the table and you look at how many goals they're not scoring at the moment, it's not a great look. They don't draw many games. They haven't actually drawn a game this season. And you look at the other teams around, you know, Burnley, I don't think they're going to get rid of their manager. Bournemouth have taken a bit of a risk on their manager, but has got a pretty good reputation. Luton, I mean, I don't think there's any reason for them to get rid of Rob Edwards. Same with Dyche at Everton, Silver at Fulham, O'Neill at Wolves. You're looking at those managers and you think that they're probably actually quite safe in their jobs at the minute. And it may be that we get to a position where managers actually stayed at a club if things didn't go well and were given the opportunity to make it better or make it right, which, you know, may happen. Whether it happens at United with everything that's gone on, especially with sort of the conduct of some of their players, and all the news stories that are around them, which again, I think is another one of those things that might not have happened previously in Alex Ferguson's days. Certainly, I think Ten Hag is definitely on borrowed time. Okay, so I'd like to throw in there another manager who's not quite on borrowed time, but is given notice on their current job. And it's the news that Emma Hayes will be leaving Chelsea in the WSL at the end of this season. There were initially rumours around about what her next job would be. It said that it was out of club football and out of the WSL. So obviously it doesn't take long for people to put two and two together and make America. So it looks like she's going to get the national team job of the US women's team, which I think is an incredible role, an incredible opportunity for Emma Hayes, who's been one of the most, if not the most successful women's manager, certainly in our domestic game. She's won many league titles with Chelsea. They're currently leading the way in the WSL at the minute. They're undefeated through their first five games. She's been at Chelsea. It'll be roughly 12 years when she actually leaves there. And is a manager who has really sort of developed her personality, her managerial style, the way that she works. She is very much a tactician who's changed styles over a number of years. And more recently, it's been great to see her insight on coaching and her role as a manager and looking at what tactics look like in the roles that she's done on television. And I think actually it's been a real refreshing change to see someone like Emma Hayes give an insight into a football match rather than talking about the stories around it with VAR or, you know, who spent X, Y or Z on whatever player. And I certainly think that she'll be missed from the English game, the English women's game and the men's game too. But it's a huge opportunity for a manager to take over a national team like the USA, who have been perennially dominant in international competition. And I think we'll probably continue that under Emma Hayes. Dave, I think her legacy is already cemented as a manager in England, but it is a huge opportunity to take on such a massive national team who with a huge responsibility to succeed. It's an amazing move, isn't it?
I think you'd say it's probably the biggest job in women's football as a coach. I mean, after they had such a poor World Cup by their standards, it's, I mean, not a rebuild, but obviously there's lots of expectations now on something to change over there. She's coached over there in the past in Chicago, so she knows the game over there a little bit. Obviously, the Olympics coming up next year is a big thing in women's football, unlike in men's football. So that's an opportunity to make a stand sort of straight away, and then to rebuild the American team, which kind of expects to win the World Cup, you know, every time that it's played. So it's a fantastic opportunity. And you're right. I mean, I think, you know, she's left a huge legacy, obviously, at Chelsea. I think it's 13 trophies so far that she's won there. But more than that, just changing the approach to women's football, giving it, I suppose, a more professional sense. We're operating in the same kind of way as a men's football club would, you know, with all the sort of analysis and backroom and study of the game that we expect from men's football. She's played a big part in moving Chelsea massively forward, but just in moving the Women's Super League forward and moving football in this country forward for women. I think she'll be, as you say, she'll be greatly missed, and certainly missed on television as well, because, as you say, it makes a change for somebody to talk about football as opposed to footballers or, you know, or the soap opera that goes around football all of the time. So you know, she's made a big contribution on that front. And I think, you know, all the things that she's done, I think, has put her in a position where she thoroughly deserves the opportunity in America. As I say, it's the biggest job in women's football, I would say, and good luck to her next year.
Aidan, it's a huge, huge loss for Chelsea. And I know we touched on it a little bit with Alex Ferguson at Manchester United. And when you create a huge legacy at one club, setting out to replace a manager like that is enormous, isn't it? But I suppose they can and will move forward from that. They're, you know, they're a well-resourced club with a strong playing staff. But she will be an incredibly different person to replace, and not just a sort of a manager from a footballer sense, won't she?
Oh, very much so. I guess she's become a high-profile manager, which in the women's game, that, well, I guess she's the first of her kind really to have reached that level of profile. And sure, some of that has come from her punditry on men's tournaments and men's matches, as well as on women's ones. But, you know, the insight she's been able to give has been, as you say, a different level in some cases. And it's opened your eyes to certain aspects of the game that you wouldn't necessarily have got. And that's great. I think in terms of Chelsea as a club, the impact on them, we've talked, yes, about Ferguson, the length of the shadow that he still casts over it. Wenger, likewise at Arsenal. And if you think back in the past, people like Matt Busby and Shankly and so on, when they still hung around at times, never made it easy for others to follow. I think the difference here, and maybe this will work out for the better for Chelsea, is that she's not retiring and going off into some directorial role or some sort of overseeing thing and being a permanent burdening presence at Chelsea that, you know, is always casting an eye over what those who come after her are doing and failing with or trying to achieve and not living up to what she's been able to do. She's going to be elsewhere. She's going to be in a different competition. She's going to be in, well, entirely different competitions, international games. Dave's absolutely right. That's probably the biggest job she could go to. And that's in terms of an achievement for an English football manager is absolutely astounding, given the nation she's going to is the biggest women's footballing nation. And for them to be taking an English manager is, well, it says a lot about her. And maybe too about the American game currently. But that is a remarkable achievement. But I think it's important that the difference it might make for Chelsea, like I say, is the fact she won't be sticking around. She won't be getting in the way, if you like, of who's to come next. It will be a very tough act to follow. You know, there's no getting away from that. And it will be hard, but it won't be getting made harder by her still being there, which is, I think, where the Ferguson factor has certainly had a big impact on those who followed at Manchester United. I think equally, though, for the Women's Super League, the impact is there as well. Like I say, she's very high profile, a recognisable character, more so than any of the other managers in the league. therefore it's a loss to WSL. There's no getting away from that. However, it can be also viewed, though, like I say, as a positive that the WSL has created or allowed Emma Hayes to become what she's become and to get taken off to the high profile job she's gone to. That is a credit for the WSL. So yes, some of that success is now going against them, going against the league and going against Chelsea. But, you know, it should be viewed as a positive overall that this is happening to somebody who's come through working in the WSL and has reached that status and reached that level. It will be interesting to see if other characters emerge domestically to sort of take her place as the highest profile and how that all plays out. But I think overall it should just be viewed as a terrific achievement for her personally, but also for the domestic game in England to have produced or to have enabled Emma to reach the status she has. I mean, what do you think, Rob, in terms of the impact and the status of what she's doing?
I think it's quite incredible, really, because I suppose what we should be looking towards as a league, whether it's women's football or men's football, is what is the impact that we're having on football in other areas. Now, we talked a little bit about Harry Kane moving from the Premier League and being developed in our league to actually move to the Bundesliga. Hayes is doing it as a manager, moving to, as Dave says, one of the biggest jobs or the biggest job in world football. What's the legacy of the Premier League? You know, the men's Premier League, is it just that we can sell TV rights across the world and we can afford to buy all the best players? Or is it that we're sort of at the forefront of developing football tactics, developing players? You know, is that always there? Maybe not. And I think when the best people are being taken from your league elsewhere, it can only be a real positive. And you can only think that being an international manager is a little bit different to being a club manager. So you'd expect to spend still quite a bit of time in England, maybe being part of men's and women's football coverage, possibly. But I think, like you sort of both hinted at, it's a huge positive for the WSL and a really important step for them and for Emma Hayes to take, I think, and having a go at that big job. And, you know, maybe if she does well at that job, maybe the England job becomes available in the next few years or in you know, a cycle or two's time, and then she comes back and maybe even takes on that role. But, yeah, I mean, I'd love it if we had more English managers in our game, in the men's game, I suppose, that could then, you know, develop and maybe move abroad and take whatever they think into other areas of football. But maybe that's a long way off.
It's interesting, though, talking about the England job, because obviously, yes, that's the other high-profile manager in this country, but not an English one. And you'd wonder if Emma Hayes would be taking this opportunity if it seemed likely that the England job would be available anytime soon. And obviously, Serena Wiegmann is doing so well with them, current couple of results aside, that that's very, very unlikely to be the case unless she chooses to leave. But maybe a few years in a World Cup campaign with America, we'll see Emma Hayes performing a very successful audition to take over from Wiegmann in a few years.
Yeah, and it's quite clear that she must want to challenge herself as a manager. You know, it's very different being a club manager to an international manager and obviously working with different players, with different pressures. And obviously the US system's very different to the English one as well. So yeah, I mean, it'd be quite interesting to see how that one develops. But our final point that we're looking ahead towards, Dave is going to talk to us about the television, not what he's been watching on the television, but football TV rights, especially the sort of some of the struggles that other countries might be having that are not as strong, powerful and rich as the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned what's the Premier League done for the world. Well, it is. I think it's knackered everybody else's television rights by and large. In France, they've cancelled the domestic rights auction because the bids weren't big enough. There's a similar story going on in Portugal as well. And I just wonder if that's a reflection of. I mean, the Premier League has had this fantastic run of, you know, it's been the league, hasn't it, for 25 years now, probably a little bit longer, and has dwarfed everything else. But maybe the appetite for football television is starting to wane a little bit. I mean, I've read a few things around this, and particularly the French one. Obviously, with Messi and Neymar leaving Paris Saint-Germain, there's a lot of talk about, well, the big stars have gone, so that's it. That's where, you know, the money's not there anymore. People don't want to watch the game if those two aren't playing. And obviously, these auctions would carry on for the next 2 or 3 years. And Mbappe, you suspect he's not going to be there much longer either. So why do people want to watch French football in that case? I mean, I don't know that that necessarily applies to Portugal, because they've always tended to be an exporter of their best talent by and large. But there's a lot of talk about this is a younger audience now that is following individuals rather than following teams and following leagues, which is a major shift if they're right in that. And I suppose that will then tend to draw the money away to Saudi Arabia, given the way that things are going. And they're by and large buying older players at the minute, but you can't see that that's going to carry on for too much longer. I mean, you know, I'm sure they'll start to have players in their prime before too long. And then what does that do to television? Is that what a younger audience, you know, up to the age of sort of 25, 26, 27, wants to watch? Are they obsessed with watching Neymar rather than watching their local, you know, their football team, that kind of thing? I think it also says a lot about the way football has failed to, not to market itself, but to look after what it is that's special about football. You know, I mean, we've all, between us, supported football clubs that have won, I don't know, about two trophies in the last 50 years. For the most part, our teams have been crap through most of our lives. And the reason that you go is because you expect to see, one day you will see another Malcolm McDonald, another Janinho, another Cyril Regis, another Wilf Mannion, another, you know, whoever it is. And we've got away from all of that sort of stuff. We don't, you know, when they want to sell you a new shirt, they'll mention the heroes of the 70s or the 60s or the 80s, whichever shirt it happens to be. And then they'll put them away again for the next 12 months and then dig them out again when they want to make you feel a bit dewy-eyed about your football club. And I think that's a big mistake. I think if you are constantly saying that, you know, your football club has a bigger purpose, it's been around for 100 years or whatever it is, it's part of the community, it's the one constant in your community. I mean, I don't know about, probably not so much Newcastle, obviously a bigger place, but West Bromwich. The only thing that's lasted in West Bromwich for 120 years is the football club, nothing else. You know, and that football club has been on the same ground since 1900. Now, that, I think, is a big selling point. That makes you feel something, surely. You know, that makes you feel that you are part of something bigger than just watching Neymar playing and rolling around on the floor. I just think football clubs per se miss out on that, because largely because the people who are there in charge only want to know about the successes they've had. They feel intimidated by the fact that, you know, you might have won a cup in the past or several cups or a league or whatever it is. And then under their ownership, well, it's not going quite so well. And they don't want to draw attention to that fact. But that's what gets the people coming. There is no sense in having a season ticket at a place like West Brom, other than the fact that one day you might see another Tony Brown, another Cyril Regis, another Brian Robson. That's the point. I mean, remarkably, they do still sell 20,000 season tickets and all of that, which is an amazing thing. But I think the thing that makes you feel something is that you are part of a bigger story. And I think that's what the TV companies are missing as well now, you know, because they are so fixated on the current and on the current star, whoever that current star is, that when that goes, what have you got left behind? You know, you're selling, you're entirely reliant on there being a new Cristiano Ronaldo. And there might not be, not in your league, you might be in some other league. You know, and then what are you going to do? So, you know, I think there needs to be a rethink in how we market the game and think about the game and think about it as having its roots. You know, it's one of the central things in this country. It's one of the things that matters. People are more interested in who their football club manager is than who the Prime Minister is, you know, by and large, which may say a lot for the state of the country at the current moment, but that's another story. I just think, you know, we've got something unique in this country. Beyond it, there's no other football country in the world that has the same professional structure, league structure, deep roots into the communities that we do, and we don't really make anything of it. And I think ultimately the Premier League will not be the world's league forever, and there'll be a time when we want to remember that, you know, there's a bigger thing than Sky Sports.
Yeah, it's really interesting that as we've probably allowed the game to grow wider, we've actually allowed it to get smaller, in the sense that, you know, we've focused our energy on growing the game across the world from a television point of view, but actually focused out all the eyeballs on a very small number of players in a very small number of leagues. I mean, we started off talking about the Copa Libertadores, and there's probably so many people who watch that on BBC Three thinking, this isn't as good as the Premier League. These players wouldn't get a game for Juventus. They wouldn't get a game for... Rather than thinking these are two teams from this continent playing in a final, this is a game of football with history, with tradition, with the kits, as you'd mentioned earlier on, Aidan, with these different players, with different playing styles. Judge the game for the game that you're seeing. Same as if you go to a non-league ground, isn't it? You know, you judge the team and the ground and the players for what you've got in front of you. And I think maybe, as you say, Dave, the younger generation have not been helped in that way, in the sense of all of the things around football is around a small pool of star players. Whereas even if you go back to, let's say, the 90s, obviously when the Champions League sort of boom happened, you still had a number of teams who were very competitive across Europe because the talent wasn't funneled into the teams with the most television money. And I think, Aidan, that's probably going to be one of the legacies of the Premier League, isn't it? It's sort of funneling talent to the top few teams, and then maybe because that competitive balance isn't there, someone doesn't want a season ticket at West Bromwich anymore, or they don't want a season ticket at Middlesbrough, or they don't want a season ticket at Oldham, and they want to watch those stars that they've been told are the best, and they play all the best games, and they've scored the most goals, and you can be them on a... And all those kind of stories that go within it. It does seem like we're kind of reaching that point, especially in Europe.
Yeah, it's like the sort of end game of capitalism, isn't it? Of like everything's funneled to the very top, and everyone else just falls by the wayside until you realise there's not a lot left. It's true, and the more money comes into things, the worse it gets. And I've been constantly thinking that the value that football rights go for has peaked, and it can't possibly just keep rising and rising and rising, not like exponentially rising the way it does. You know, if it just went up bit by bit, you could understand that for inflation reasons, but the way it's just escalated is astonishing. And yet there are remarkably few people actually watch these games live in this country. I know we're talking a lot about international rights, and that's possibly another matter. Domestically, the viewing figures, they rarely publish them because they are so bad. A fellow Teesside of yours, Rob, have you ever read John Nicholson's books on the subject? Yeah. He goes into a lot of detail, and they are fascinating, but I would urge anyone to read those. They're absolutely terrific. And he talks a lot about how little these things are watched, these games are watched, and yet they're paying so much money for them. It is bizarre. I don't understand the finances of it. Maybe that's just my tiny mind not quite working out, because there's only so many subscriptions people will buy. And nowadays there are other ways of getting around all of that. But equally, does it impact on people wanting to go and see what is viewed or perceived as a lesser product? You know, you mentioned the sort of criticisms there that people would have of watching, might say, about watching lower league or watching another league, saying it's not the best. You know, I want to see the best, and here it is. I can watch it on telly or on YouTube clips or whatever it may be. It's the same as people sometimes criticize women's football because it's not as good as the men's. Therefore, that's me saying other people's words, not my words. I hasten to add, it's a different game. It's a different product, and view it for what it is and enjoy it for what it is. It's football, it's sport, it's competitive, and it's fun. It doesn't have to be the best. People criticize international football for the same reason. It's not as good as the Champions League. Well, so what? The World Cup is still the most exciting of things as it gets to its latter stages, far beyond any club competition could ever manage. It captures so many more people. The quality doesn't matter. It's the competition. It's the challenge. It's the sport in it, and that's what people are drawn to. The value of anything is only what people are willing to pay. And like I say, maybe if the French league are struggling to sell it because of they anticipated the value being more than anyone else did. Well, that doesn't, you know, that you can't just set a price and expect anyone to pay it. The value is what it's actually worth. And if TV companies don't think it's viable, and like I say, I think this may hit England eventually, because the money just can't keep going up. You know, if these companies don't think it's viable at that price, then it isn't viable at that price. They'll be losing too much money. And where's the point in that? I don't know. It will be interesting the way it plays out. The whole Saudi League thing, again, doesn't feel like it'll be a lasting contender to dominate in the way the Premier League has. But it has changed things massively. And I think it may ultimately impact on Champions League or European Super League or whatever may come. And that expands its horizons beyond Europe into something that includes clubs from Saudi Arabia or other nations as well, as the money moves there, possibly. We'll see that kind of change. I just can't, for the life of me, see that there'll be much appeal in people wanting to watch the Saudi League, other than people who like to see a few clips of Ronaldo scoring 3 or 4 goals and Neymar tumbling and crying, as Dave mentioned. You just can't imagine, other than people wanting to view little clips, that, and therefore you don't get big TV rights from that. You might get a little bit of engagement, but surely you don't get the big TV rights. It will be interesting to see how things carry on. Ultimately, though, what Dave talks about of what a club is to its community and what the league structure is and all the history that's gone with it, ultimately the finances will crash and burn one day, or it will change in some way. It won't stay like this and it won't keep rising forever. And maybe the clubs who have the money now will suffer the hardest because of that, possibly. And everything will change in a different way, and it might become more poorer in terms of finances, but richer in terms of all sorts of other things. Maybe that will happen. It would be interesting to see how it plays out. And I don't think it can continue on this steep upward path for too much longer. But then I've thought that for quite a while, and it's still carrying on.
Just that point on the Saudi League, Dave, what sort of legacy and impact will that have in, you know, in the short term, the next 2 or 3 years, maybe in 5 or 10 years? Is it going to end up being like an MLS type league that's quite well established over time? Or is it going to be a flash in the pan like the sort of Chinese Super League was for a very short period of time?
Well, I think it's going to be here to stay. The Saudis are obviously making a major play in football. As we know, with buying up football clubs and so on around Europe. The World Cup in 2034 is obviously going to be a big thing. They're going to want to have a strong league in place by that point. And with the money that they've got, there's no reason why they can't have one. You know, I mean, for all that the Chinese league, when that came about, seemed as though it was going to start attracting players. The same kind of finance wasn't there. And particularly the way that things have changed economically over the last 10 years. That's changed things a bit in China. But in Saudi Arabia, there just seems to be that bottomless pit of money that they can, whatever they turn their mind to, they can carry on doing. And I mean, you know, I do take Aidan's point, but I think what they're saying about the demographics of TV watching and stuff is that a younger audience doesn't want to, even 90 minutes is too long to watch. They don't really want to watch a game of football. They want to watch the 3 minutes of fancy free kicks and, you know, a bit of showboating and a couple of goals. And that's basically the diet that they want. I don't know if that's true or not, but that seems to be what a lot of the TV companies are coming up with now. If that is the case, then, as Aidan says, that can't justify this huge amount of money that they are currently pumping into leagues all over the world, television companies, and it will change. You know, perhaps we'll go back to Match of the Day, where it's edited highlights of everything, rather than showing live games. I don't know, but nothing goes on forever. You know, I mean, in the 80s and 90s, Serie A was always going to be the biggest league in the world, wasn't it? and now they're scratching around kind of thing. This run that the Premier League's had of 25, 30 years nearly is unprecedented. But nothing lasts forever. And you wonder what will be left when we do finally reach that point where TV rights don't go up again. That's going to be an interesting point. Because we can't be far off that. It can't keep going up and up and up and up. There's got to come a point where it's hit the ceiling and then from there it's down.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe that point of nothing lasts forever is a nice finish to this podcast, because we've talked across a whole wide range of stories, from South America's Premier Cup competition to our very own English Emma Hayes taking over the US women's national team. But maybe we need to have some more discussion around the future of football, what it looks like on television, what the EFL is going to do with their new bargaining agreement with the Premier League, what television rights are going to look like next year with 10 EFL games every weekend with a new European format of a Champions League. So there's certainly more meat for us to get into our teeth into on today's Football Times. But thank you, everybody, for listening. Aidan, Dave, thanks for joining me for another good in-depth football chat.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, thank you.
And obviously, if you've enjoyed this, do let us know. Do make sure you listen again in the future for more chat about football in the modern era. Thanks, everyone.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a Thees Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.